Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. This week on the Garden DC podcast, we're joined by Jonathan Cavalier. He is the Director of Gardens and Grounds at Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And as you might know, Jonathan, Dumbarton Oaks is one of my favorite gardens in the entire world, and not just the D.C. area, and for good reason. So we're going to talk about all things Dumbarton Oaks, the history, what's going on today, maybe some of the future of the garden. But first, we want to talk about you and your background a little bit, Jonathan, and how you came to Dumbarton Oaks. But we have to ask our question of, were you born with chlorophyll in your veins and a green thumb?
I was, and I wasn't born at Dumbarton Oaks, and I wasn't conceived at Dumbarton Oaks, but my parents did spend a lot of time here, and they lived right across the street. So,
oh, nice.
I grew up loving gardening. My dad was an avid gardener, although he mostly only grew azaleas. So I don't grow a lot of azaleas, but, I spent my childhood with a love of gardening, and then I had a cathartic experience in Israel in between high school and college, working on a kibbutz in the largest date orchard in Israel on Kibbutz Tiretzvi. And that really crystallized things for me. And I realized I wanted to do this as a career. So I had already decided to go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I had planned to study physics, and I transferred into the agriculture school in my freshman year, and the rest is history.
Wow. And that experience growing fruit trees in Israel, is any of that applicable to the DC area, I wonder, with the different climates?
Yes. Well, I mean, just the love of cultivating plants is what got me started. I think definitely moving around and trying different things, and private landscape design and public, exploring the world of public gardens. I got to spend some time in Madagascar in 2006, working over there doing landscape design and some rehabilitation of mining sites. And that's really where the experience in Israel helped me gain a deeper appreciation and love for tropical plants and growing fruit trees and other tropical plants. That experience led me to the Smithsonian to work with the tropical plant collection for Smithsonian Gardens. And so, I would say, you know, the work with tropical plants and starting in Israel really led me down a path. But I love learning about new aspects of horticulture that I'm not familiar with. And there are so many that it really has been a great journey to, you know, explore a lifelong passion for learning.
And the Smithsonian was a great opportunity to do that as well, I'm sure.
Yes. And the Smithsonian was really my first foray into the world of public gardening. And I think, you know, I was not exposed to public gardens as a possibility in a career development when I was in college. And my advisors, there didn't seem to be a strong awareness, at least it was at the University of Wisconsin, for careers in public gardening. And so I was really coming to the Smithsonian, it really opened up a whole new world for me. And I think, you know, the mission of getting people interested in gardens who might never go to a garden. And, you know, the amazing thing about the Smithsonian is some of the gardens are just on public sidewalks and people walk past them on their way to work who may never experience or be interested in a garden. So the opportunity to expose people to plants and really cultivate that interest is something that I really, really cherished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's kind of a misunderstanding a little bit with the public about the Smithsonian Gardens and where they fit in on the National Mall, because they blend in so seamlessly with the surrounding architecture and with the museums that they're adjacent to that people don't think of them as separate gardens. So you have to actually look at the map to realize, no, there are several gardens all around the National Mall.
Right. And very unique and diverse gardens as well.
Mm-hmm. And so very different from where you are now at Dumbarton Oaks, where there is a definite gate and a definite entrance into that yes. garden. And you are stepping off of a semi-busy street in Georgetown in Washington, D.C., through a very ornate gate that has the name scrolled on it. And I think it's wrought iron, I believe.
Yes. Cast iron, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cast iron. And then you're going, being admitted through a little entry gate with a security guard there with your name on a list or a ticket system.
Yes. Yeah. Very different atmosphere. Beatrix Farren, who designed the gardens with Mildred Bliss, even writes about that entrance. And of course, at that time, the gardens were a private garden. But she writes about the mixed border on the R Street edge of the property as, and she says something to the effect of it should in no way feel like we are screening people out from the place, but that's exactly what it should do. mm-hmm. So, you know, it's definitely a different mission, a very different feel from a place like the Smithsonian. It took me a big adjustment coming here from the Smithsonian where, you know, at the Smithsonian, the mission is to welcome as many visitors as possible to the museums and gardens. And that's just not possible here with the challenges that we have with access and pathways and topography and just the historic nature of this garden and our preservation mission doesn't always fit well with lots of visitors. So it was definitely an adjustment for me to come to terms with the fact that we are open to the public, but our primary mission is not necessarily as a public garden.
Hmm. And during COVID, you were closed the grounds for most of that period, and now they're reopened, but it's on a timed entry system, and you have to register in advance. You can't do so at the gate.
That is correct. Yes, we closed down completely. In fact, the whole campus closed down for COVID. The only groups that were on site were the gardeners and facility group and security, really. So it's been a very quiet year and a half for us in the gardens, although we did have to space out and work on our scheduling to de-densify the campus. So the end result of all that and the loss of interns and summer temporary gardeners really resulted in about a 40% labor reduction in the gardens during COVID. So it's been a lot of catch up for us. The gardens were closed just because the maintenance became so difficult, but also for safety reasons and a real hesitancy from Harvard to want to potentially open us up to as a place for COVID spread. So now we're reopened to the public. We actually have welcomed our residential fellows back to the property. For those people who don't know, Dumbarton Oaks, in addition to having the historic garden, we function as a Harvard research center in the humanities, specifically in the areas of Byzantine, pre-Columbian, and garden and landscape studies. And so this fall, we've been fortunate to welcome close to 50 residential fellows to the property to once again engage with the collections and work on research. And with that, and the public garden opening this spring, and the museum, which just opened a couple weeks ago and is featuring a Margaret Mee exhibit, so we're really excited to kind of try and get back to normal.
Hmm. And glad you brought up the fellowships because you said residential fellowships. That means they stay on property there?
Yes, yes. Some of them are virtual, but most of them are here on property now. We have a residential dormitory on Wisconsin Avenue, as well as some other housing.
Oh, I was thinking they got to stay in the big house.
No, the big house is largely museum mm-hmm. space, collection storage, office space, and then some performance space for musical events.
But they do have that one great perk, Jonathan, and that's that beautiful swimming pool out back, right?
Yes, they do get to enjoy the swimming pool.
And that's, I don't think, open to the public, but after hours for staff and for the fellows.
Yes, yeah, it's one of the perks of being a staff or fellow here is you get to use the swimming pool.
Mm-hmm. It does look very tempting in the summertime, I must say.
It's a lovely pool. It's amazing to be in a swimming pool in a historic garden and just be surrounded by the beauty. It is a pretty special experience.
Well, before we jump into the pool, let's maybe start with how a visitor, after they come through those gates and gets checked in, approaches the house and then enters the main part of the gardens. So you kind of come up the south lawn, I believe it is, and you've got the facade of the house facing you, and you're kind of led up to a side area, the orangery.
Yes, and this is the highest portion of the property. One of the striking things about the gardens is that there's about a 100-foot drop from that high point down north towards Rock Creek, and then a 50-foot drop to the east down towards Montrose Park. So when you come up that driveway and you're standing at the orangery, you're on the highest point of the property. The orangery itself is amazing because it was it's the second oldest orangery in the U.S. It was modeled after the oldest orangery, which is at the Y House in Maryland. And it has inside of it a creeping fig, a Ficus pimila, that was planted in the 1860s and now covers almost the entire interior of the room. That's really a striking display.
Yeah, that plant, it's almost like, you know, it's living and breathing. And this almost like it is the room itself. Like if the walls were to fall down, I feel like that plant would still be there surrounding you. It's so incredible to be inside that.
Yes, and it is. And it also presents some interesting tensions between historic preservation of architecture and plants and, you know, having living collections in a historic room, you know, and the light and humidity and moisture requirements and all those things. So it's an interesting case study.
Hmm. And for the summertime, I think the citrus is pulled out of the orangery and put on the back patio. Do you move it back in and close that all up for the winter?
Yes, we display a number of tropical plants, including some citrus trees, but also other things like gardenia and cycads and so forth. And those all come back into the orangery for the winter. So it really does function as a functional orangery for overwintering tropical plants.
And for those listeners, Jonathan had mentioned the Y House in Maryland, and that's W-Y-E. So if you wanted to look up the history of that a little bit and check out their orangery, you can do so as well. So once you pass through the orangery, then you're in the gardens. And the first thing that you're encountering is kind of a formal patio area. And then to your right is a beautiful tree. Can you describe that tree, Jonathan?
Yes, it's a stunning American beech. And what is so stunning about it is that I don't know if it was intentionally topped or it lost its central leader at a very young age, but that has resulted in all the lateral branches really taking dominance. And so it is a very unique form for an American beech tree. It's got, I think, a 60-foot spread on the canopy, and it just fills the entire space of that terrace. It's the first of a series of terraces that Beatrix Farren designed and cut into the landscape in a very sensitive way to try and work around existing grades and trees while also providing a comfortable way of accessing the steep topography.
Yeah, that tree is so incredible, the spread on it. It reminds me of those really ancient ginkgo trees or those ancient oaks where they're more almost horizontal than they are vertical.
Yeah. What's amazing to me about that tree is, and I ask every visitor when I'm giving tours and we walk through that area, how old they think that tree is. Most people think it predates Farren's work at the house because of its size and scale, but that tree was actually planted in the 1960s as a replacement to the original beech. Which was a European purple beech. So it's not even that old, which is really stunning.
So within a person's lifetime, we can definitely achieve that look too.
Yes.
That sounds like a fun one. So we should probably rewind a little bit for listeners and talk about the Blisses and Beatrix Farren and how that garden came to be. So I think it was Robert and Mildred Bliss who bought the property. And before that, it was more of like an English country style estate.
Yes, the house was built in 1801. The original property consisted of most of Georgetown, was deeded to a Scotsman named Ninian Beale. And he divided the land up, divided it amongst his sons, and then it further got divided. Eventually, the Blisses were, I think, the fifth or sixth owner. John Calhoun lived in the house while he was vice president of the United States. And then a gentleman named Edward Linthicum lived in the house in the mid-1800s. We think it was he that planted the ficus pamela, as well as some really iconic trees on the property. He hired an English gardener. And so some trees that predate the Blisses and Farrens, we think, are from the Linthicum era. So the Blisses purchased the property in 1920, and their intention was to have a country house in the city. Robert Bliss was a diplomat for the State Department, and so they spent actually most of the 20 years that they owned the house abroad. He was stationed in Europe during World War I in France, and he ended his career as the American U.S. diplomat to Argentina. And that explains some of the collecting of pre-Columbian and Byzantine art that they did. What's really interesting is when you look at the way that the gardens were designed, because the Blisses weren't here while the gardens were being developed, they hired Beatrix Farren early on in 1921. She came to look at the property for the first time. And at that time, she was already doing work at Princeton and Yale and really had had a solid career under her belt. So, you know, over the next 20 years, she iteratively designed this landscape in close collaboration with Mildred Bliss, and the two of them became really close friends. We are so fortunate that we have a lot of the correspondence shared between them. Because the Blisses were abroad, Farren would trade letters back and forth with Mildred Bliss discussing ideas for the gardens. She would send sketches, often multiple iterations of an idea or an ornament. And then once Miss Bliss approved a concept, Farren would then often create a full-scale mock-up. So this is particularly important with the ornament and furniture, most of which throughout the garden she designed. And so mock-ups and photographs would be sent back and forth with rulers for showing the scale. And once a final element was selected, then Farren would have it completed. So that rich level of documentation really gives us a lot of insight into the concepts and kind of aesthetics that were being discussed when the gardens were being developed. And I think the real genius of this place is Farren's vision. She really seamlessly blends American and French, Italian and English styles in a way that is wholly unique, but really reminisces from those various styles. But it's done in such a seamless way, you never feel like you're in the English garden or the French garden or the Italian garden. It just all blends together. And then I think also what is really speaks to the genius of her design at Dumbarton Oaks is her use of symmetry and asymmetry and playing off of tricks in the topography to give you these amazing conceal and reveal moments where you will come around a blind corner and then be struck with a main access through the garden or a point of interest that is fairly tricky, I think, and very intentional. And then the seamless way that she allows the formality to fall away from the gardens as you leave the house. Something that she picked up from William Robinson in England, who she visited in her youth as she was learning and studying European gardens. It's really masterfully done. When you're up on that terrace that we were just talking about with the beech tree, you're surrounded by a lot of brick lattice walls and limestone coping and kind of very formal plantings. And then as you make your way down the terrace gardens, you end up in a wilderness eventually. And it's just a very fluid movement through that process.
Mm-hmm. So it's going from the really formal by the house to the really informal by the time you're at the bottom of the hill and almost into Rock Creek Park.
Yes. And originally she designed all of that, what is now Dumbarton Oaks Park in Rock Creek Park, as a naturalistic wild garden. And she went to great lengths to expand the creek in several areas, adding waterfalls and dams to create reflecting pools, which were planted with native and non-native bulbs and understory plantings. So it was really, it was a much larger garden than it is today. And the naturalistic part and the formal part were in better conversation with each other, I think. When the Blisses donated the property to Harvard in 1940, they decided to give 27 acres to the National Park Service, which is now Dumbarton Oaks Park. And so the property was divided, and that that sent the two portions of the gardens on different trajectories in terms of their maintenance and mission.
You put that very politely, Jonathan, because Dumbarton Oaks Park was kind of let to go almost fallow And a lot of it is being redone by volunteers now. And so there's still touches that you can definitely see of the Farron landscape, but a lot of it has gone away. But I'm super happy to see the DeBarton Oaks Park Conservancy get involved and that the local neighbors are involved and people are helping with cleanups and restoring that section of yes. that landscape.
No, they're really doing great work. And you know, in their defense, not only is it, you know, a resourcing issue, I think, with the National Park Service in terms mm-hmm. of what they can maintain, but things have changed so much in Georgetown over the years. And that park is down at the bottom of the watershed. So, you know, all the development on Wisconsin Avenue, there's just been a tremendous increase, I think, in stormwater issues and invasive plant issues that have really, I think, made their job a lot harder than it ever was.
And that does bring up stormwater and some of the issues on the property because it is such a steep property. I know that a few years ago, you had redone some of that.
Yes. Yes, I came on board at Dumbarton Oaks here just at the tail end of that project. We did a large stormwater management project in 2017 and 2018, which had three goals. One was to bring in new water supply line into the garden because the 100-year-old pipes were failing left and right. So about a mile of new water supply was run through the garden in a very circuitous and strategic path to avoid as many trees as possible. And some really exceptional interventions were made. There was directional boring underneath of trees and you know, things like that, air spade trenches and things to try and prevent damage to mature trees. The second goal of that project was to minimize the stormwater that is going down the hill into the park. So some new stormwater infrastructure was put in place, some gutters, some additional storm drain inlets. And then we, since that, have increased some of the plantings and done some grading work to further reduce that potential for runoff down the hill. And the last thing the project did was to retrofit some of the fountains from, you know, what was the common practice 100 years ago, to build a fountain with a fresh water feed and an overflow that would take the excess water out into the storm system. We've been retrofitting those into recirculating systems to save water and, you know, reduce inputs.
I didn't realize that they were originally just spring-fed water features there.
Yes. Well, it was all municipal water, but there was, was no recirculating system. So it's just like leaving 13 faucets on. So we have 13 fountains throughout the garden.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah. But now we're down to, I think, two left that are not recirculating. And mm-hmm. And those are really very small fountains with very little flow. But all the major ones, the big fountain at the Ellipse and the Lover's Lane Pool, the Fountain Terrace fountains have all been converted to recirculating systems.
Great. So let's focus on some of those really iconic points in the garden that you go through. And maybe we'll start off with maybe the first one that you see in a growing season or might encounter, which is the Forsythia hillside.
Yes, the Forsythia Dell. It's an amazing piece of garden with a full acre of Forsythia tumbling down what is some of the steepest topography on the property just before you enter the park. And originally, actually, that Forsythia Hill extended down into what is now Dumbarton Oaks Park. There are still some remnants of the Forsythia left. But it's a really striking mass, and the effect, the architectural effect, which is what Farron was really going for, is really stunning to see these plants spilling down like a green or yellow waterfall, depending on the time of year. It's also interesting that we have a variety of Forsythia. The primary variety in the Forsythia Dell is the Spectabilis cultivar, but we also have on an adjacent hillside planted a Forsythia variety that is named Beatrix Farron and was an Arnold Arboretum introduction, which is, I think, really great because that is where she started her studies in horticulture under Charles Sargent while the Arboretum was being laid out.
Ah, that's really cool. I didn't know about that cultivar of the Forsythia. I'll have to collect that one myself.
Yeah, it's a more weeping habit is the main difference.
Yeah, and if you've ever grown Forsythia on a hillside or a slope, it does have that tendency to tip, like to lean over, touch the ground, and start a new plant where it touches the ground, and then continue to crawl almost or go down that hillside. So it's almost self-propagating in that way.
Yes, it is. And that came in really handy at the tail end of that stormwater project, because one of the areas they ran a major storm line and several new drain inlets was down through Wisteria or Forsythia Dell. So we had a big swath of bare ground to deal with. And we were very lucky to have such a planting of Forsythia that we could take cuttings and just start new plants without having to bring in nursery grown plants, because there is a lot of confusion in the nursery industry, especially with Forsythia. And so the last thing we would want to do is bring in a different variety and then have something that, that changed the ultimate design.
Mm-hmm. And around the same time as the Forsythia is blooming are some of the first spring bulbs and some of the ephemeral natives that you might have on property. Can you talk about those?
Yes. We are trying all the time to add to that, actually. The best place to see that is on Lover's Lane and Melisande's Alley over on the eastern portion of the property, where you'll see crocus, eranthus, galanthus, and all sorts of early spring bulbs. And another real early harbinger of spring at Dumbarton Oaks is the tree, some of the early flowering trees, the Prunus mume and some of the other cherries on Cherry Hill. The Prunus blariana along Plum Walk are some of the first things to bloom in the spring, along with those early ephemerals.
And you have a collection of crab apples there as well that follow those?
We do. There's a part of the garden called Crab Apple Hill that is basically a mass planting of crab apple trees. And it's really interesting, this garden, one thing I didn't mention yet is that it's not primarily a flower garden. And it kind of was a response and a pulling back from the real exuberant Victorian flower gardens. And so a lot of the flowers that we see in the spring come from the trees and shrubs. And there certainly are bulbs. There certainly are a few garden rooms that have season-long annuals such as Fountain Terrace or the Herbaceous Border. But a lot of the spring color is coming from the woody plants. And it's really interesting to see how Farrand used those plants to kind of choreograph the movement through the garden. So there are moments where you will be walking down a path and you'll get a little peek. For example, walking down Plum Walk, you'll get a peek of cherry bloom in the distance in the early spring. And that entices you to walk down the Cotoneaster steps and into Cherry Hill. But a month later, when the cherries are out of bloom, you get a peek of bloom from a dogwood at a branch in the path, and that causes you to want to follow that branch and go up to the ellipse, and then you're struck by the crab apples on Crab Apple Hill. So it's really the flowering trees that help direct the movement through the garden. It's really a fascinating thing to see.
Hmm. And those are so beautiful in the springtime in Washington, D.C. It's not all about the cherry trees down at the tidal basin.
That's right.
Brought up the ellipse. Let's talk about the trees on that. So those aren't flowering trees that circle that ellipse.
Correct. Yes. What is planted there now is a aerial hedge of American hornbeam, Carpinus caroliniana. That's an interesting part of the gardens because it changed a lot, and it shows you kind of the iterative process of both Farrand's design and then also some of the changes that were necessitated by the transition from a private garden to an institutional garden. The ellipse originally in Farrand's design was part of Boxwood Walk, which is a sloping walk and one of the major axes through the gardens that was bordered with English boxwood on either side. And you would come down to the ellipse and it was kind of like a keyhole garden where you would come into this terminus that was fully enclosed in mature American boxwood. And it was a place of solitude and reflection with a simple single jet fountain in the center of a pond. But Farrand noted even towards the end of her time working on the property that the boxwood were failing and something would need to be done. And she writes in her plant book that careful study would be needed before a decision was made. But she never got to do the careful study. She, at that point, had begun pulling away and ended up retiring from her work at Dumbarton Oaks, leaving her protege, Ruth Havey, to take over. So the ellipse has gone through quite a few changes. Ruth Havey did some designs that were never realized. And then Robert Pattinson and Ralph Griswold ended up doing some design work that resulted in the pleached hornbeam hedge that you see there now. That was actually finally realized by Alden Hopkins in the late 1960s. So, you know, a lot of these spaces have changed a lot over the years, but then we always try and bring it back to Farron's design intent. And so recently we had to replace those trees in the ellipse because they had declined. There were a number of them missing, and we decided to replace them with another set of American hornbeams. So we had them contract grown because of the special form that we needed to achieve the aerial hedge. But we're making some changes. For example, the Alden Hopkins design had a pea gravel mulch under the trees that we didn't feel contributed to their health. It encouraged a lot of foot traffic under the trees, and so we wanted to change that. And so we've brought in a ground cover instead, which we feel still gives you kind of the reflectivity of a pea gravel, but is going to be better for the trees and their you know, their future survival.
I hadn't realized that the trees were so recent. And then there's carved wooden benches in that area, and they seem fairly new as well.
Yes. Well, those benches are reproductions, and they're part of a larger project that we're working on to restore and reproduce some of the Farron designed furniture throughout the gardens. The trees we replanted in 2019. We actually did a big project down there where we excavated the soil after some studies and analysis to determine, you know, what was contributing to the tree's decline. We did a big project where we mixed a custom soil and replanted all those trees into that soil. It was about 300 yards of soil that we mixed on site down at the ellipse. We built a deck out of wood and then had some small equipment down there to do the mixing. And so those benches that you saw recently are the last element to be restored in that ellipse. And now we've kind of moved on to the next area. But the benches are fantastic. Farron designed about 45 different pieces of furniture throughout the gardens, and many of them are just one of a kind, unique pieces that were designed specifically for that particular place in the gardens. And what's amazing to me is some of these original pieces are still in the gardens, and albeit not in great shape, but we're just it's just amazing to think that you still have a bench 100 years later that Farron designed. So we've started a project a couple years ago where we've created 3D computer models of all the furniture so that we can capture the design intent, the joinery, the wood grain direction, and all those minute details that really make them masterpieces. And now we're in a process of reproducing them so that in the next 2 years, I think most of the furniture in the garden will be reproduced. And then we are going to save the originals, and some of them will be displayed interior and added to the collection.
Yeah, 100 years is a good track record for a lot of that furniture.
Yeah. And then with that, we're starting kind of hand in hand with the furniture. We've started, and this really fits with the celebration of the centennial of the garden this year. We're looking back at the last 100 years, and we're looking ahead at the next 100 years. And so we've started a project to really holistically assess and preserve all of the other Farron designed ornament throughout the gardens. Because in addition to benches and chairs and tables, she also designed urns and pepper pots and columns and all kinds of architectural element. And it's a lot of it is mixed materials. There's wood elements, there's stone, there's metal, and it's in various stages of needing intervention. So we've gone through and done an assessment of all of it. We have a 10-year plan or so to address the most critical elements. And we just finished our first project this year, which was really a great project. It was down in the Lover's Lane pool. There are a series of 15 columns that were designed by Farron and are interconnected with cast iron chains. We were able to restore those. Some of them were leaning. They had cracks throughout them. They were in various stages of being at risk for toppling over eventually. And so we were able to stabilize them and consolidate the stone and clean them up. And a couple urns on the top of a couple columns were missing, so we were able to recast from a couple of the originals that were in the best shape and reproduce urns for the missing columns. So it was a really successful project in terms of bringing that space back to a higher aesthetic level and taking care of some safety concerns as well.
Yeah, I had visited recently and noticed the upgrades around the Lover's Lane pool. And I kind of have to admit, I kind of like the shabby chicness, the kind of gray gardens look that it had before.
Yeah.
But it is obviously safer and nicer to have those restored and not being able to fall on somebody.
Yes, and that aging will come back with time. So, it's interesting. Another part of that project was we had our longtime masonry contractor, John Pond, rebuild part of the brick of the amphitheater seating in that area because the brick was decomposing. And so you can see where the new bricks are, where he fixed it. And he's been working on this property for close to 30 years, and he really is emotionally and personally invested in the gardens. And it really bothered him to see the new bricks in his own work. But what I told him is what I tell visitors as well, as we're planning for the next 100 years. So the bricks will grow moss once again, and the columns will age and look old before long.
And earlier you had mentioned the plant book that Beatrice Farrand had written, and you're very lucky at Dumbarton Oaks to have the correspondence between Bliss and Farrand, but also that book that she left, which has very detailed instructions about each of the garden rooms and the landscape there.
Yes, we are so fortunate. That correspondence that you mentioned, along with the plant book, really together serve as our preservation guide for the gardens. And it's a really exciting time for us because we're actually the plant book is out of date. It's no longer available. It's out of print. So we're actually going to be republishing it as part of our centennial celebration of the garden. We've just finished working on it, and it's out at the printers, and it'll be available in the spring of 2022. So we're keeping all of Farrand's original words about the garden, and we're just adding some introductory essays and also some updates throughout the book to give readers a contemporary view of what has changed, and in some cases explaining why we make some of the changes that we do make. But that book is just incredible because she is so articulate in laying out both why she does what she does and then how she envisions the future maintenance to be.
Yeah, I can't wait to read that update. That's going to be exciting.
Yeah, we're very excited. It's one of two books that we're producing as part of the centennial celebrations. The other book is my colleague is putting out, Thaisa Way, who is our director of garden and landscape program. And she's producing a book with essays by various landscape architects and garden historians and beautiful photography, 4 seasons of photography through Dumbarton Oaks. So we're going to have both kind of the beautiful, thoughtful, inspiring essay book and the plant book, which I really consider to be a reference book and really best read in the gardens.
Yeah, I would think bringing your copy with you and being able to sit in the garden will be an incredible experience.
Yes.
And so a couple more garden highlights that we should definitely talk about are on Dean's Walk and then, of course, the Pebble Garden. And let's start with on Dean's Walk. And I have to admit some real frustration, Jonathan, when I go on Pinterest and I see pictures looking up the divided staircase, and it'll be labeled something like garden stairs with no attribution at all that this was a Farrand design or that it was Dumbarton Oaks. So I always feel like I have to go on Instagram and Pinterest and add a note every time I see it and say, "This is at Dumbarton Oaks, people. It's not just some generic garden."
Yes. I sometimes get frustrated. We're very fortunate that there's a ton of interest out there for Dumbarton Oaks. There are so many books that have been written about Dumbarton Oaks, and so inevitably there is a lot of misinformation or lack of information about Dumbarton Oaks. And so, thank you for that. I'm not on social media these days, otherwise I would be compelled to correct those things as well.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful little shady area, little exclusion. And you talked about the hide and seek, type of aspect of the garden where you come into a new space and it's totally revealed and open to you. And this is one of those spaces where you turn to look up the stairs and it's, just a little gem, just this, a definitely Instagrammable moment where you can sit on the stairs and, you know, one partner can be on each side or you could be both at the base of it. It's just wonderful.
Yes. And actually, we were really fortunate to have Annie Leibovitz in the garden this summer photographing a fashion shoot for Vogue, which was accompanied with a fantastic article on Farrand. And it just came out. It was in the September issue of Vogue. And unfortunately, one of my favorite shots that didn't make the magazine was on those stairs. And I was really surprised that they didn't make the final cut because it was a really compelling image.
Maybe Annie will be sharing that in a future show or something.
There are some fantastic images, so I highly recommend checking it out. And a wonderful article on Farrand and her process. And
great. And so the Pebble Garden, which you see from the terrace above looking down, and you see the whole design laid out in front of you, or you can walk down into it and then see it at a more intimate level.
Yes. And that's, again, another interesting part of the garden because it's not a Farrand design. The Pebble Garden itself is a Ruth Havey design. But that's another example of the iteration and the change in intent over time. That Pebble Garden originally was a tennis court. And Mr. Bliss was an avid tennis player. Beatrix Farrand designed the walls and wall plantings, and which are still there. And actually, we were so honored last in 2020 to be included in a series of forever stamps through the U.S. Postal Service. And so there's a fantastic stamp with a picture of the wisteria blooming in Pebble Garden. And so it's a really iconic space. It's interesting, the change over time. The tennis court in the transition to Harvard had become, I think, a laydown area for the gardeners. And so in the transition to an institutional garden, it was redesigned. And Ruth Havey, what I find very interesting about Pebble Garden is it really gives you an opportunity to see the differences in Ruth Havey's style versus Beatrix Farrand's style. And Beatrix Farrand was much more restrained, I guess, in her design style. She was really inspired by arts and crafts aesthetics. And so you can see in her furniture, in her ornament, it's a very kind of neoclassic and arts and crafts melange versus Ruth Havey, who was really more enamored with Rococo style and kind of Baroque style flourishes. And so the Pebble Garden is a perfect example of that with all the Doria filigreed stone and kind of curving lines and kind of almost over the top flamboyance was very kind of trademark Ruth Havey. So it's really interesting to have that in conversation with the original walls and wall plantings.
Mm-hmm. It does remind me of my grandparents were in Bayreuth, and it reminds me of some of the Baroque and the palace gardens that are around there. Almost that feel of that with, there's hardly any plant material. It's all different mixes of stone materials and different layers. And then you have the wisteria, which only for 2 or 3 weeks is in bloom.
Yeah. Yes.
And so another highlight for me, and maybe not an iconic part of the garden, is the cutting gardens and the kitchen garden. So were those always part of the estate?
Yes, and Farrand writes about them in the plant book. So there definitely was a kitchen gardens. You know, it has certainly changed over time, and the addition of the cutting garden was something that was brought in later. But there was definitely a precedent in Farrand's time, in the Bliss's time, for growing fruits and vegetables for their use. It functioned as a victory garden during World War II. And then shortly after that, it was disbanded in the transition to Harvard and the realization that that the resources needed to be, you know, consolidated in the gardening department. They let the vegetable garden go fallow. So it was brought back, I believe, in 2008. It was before my time here. But now we have the cutting garden, which really makes a lot of sense because we do fresh flower arrangements for our residential fellow programs for the symposia, colloquia, and research talks. And you know, Miss Bliss was very much into having fresh flowers in the house. So there's a lot of precedent for that as well. And then we grow vegetables on about a quarter acre section of the kitchen garden now. We focus on vegetables that we can provide to our, we have a staff cafeteria that that provides lunch for the residential fellows and for staff. And so our goal is to provide some produce and fruits and vegetables and herbs from the gardens that the community here can enjoy.
Oh, I didn't know about the staff cafeteria. I have to get an invitation to that sometime.
Yeah, I'm waiting for it to reopen. That's one of the few things that has not reopened after COVID. But
yeah, I can imagine that that would be the latter item to be there. And so any other garden highlights that you take visitors to that are a personal favorite of yours, Jonathan?
Well, one of my favorite spots in the garden is the Lover's Lane pool area, just because I feel like it is, it almost feels like it was, it's been uncovered or excavated rather than built. And it just feels much older than it is. And I think part of that is the fact that it was inspired by a 17th century courtyard in Rome, in Accademia dell'Arcadia del Bosco, which Farron visited. And there's a courtyard there with some brick amphitheater seating and a central flagstone courtyard where poetry readings and other literary exchanges would take place. And so it's really interesting to me that Farron was inspired by that and kind of recreated it here at Dumbarton Oaks. But the theme was music, because the Blisses were so they loved music, and so they loved performance. And so this, as a place of outdoor performance, as a place of musical performance, it's just interesting to see that creation here at Dumbarton Oaks. And the last thing I would say that I love pointing out to visitors, it's not an iconic or special part of the garden, but it's something just to think about as you go through the gardens as a whole, and especially in light of the centennial, that as we look ahead to the next 100 years, we are really expanding our management criteria to both strive to preserve Farron's design intent, but also do that while being sensitive to ecological needs and ecosystem services and habitat and things like that. That the garden, you know, 16 contiguous acres in DC is important. So that's one of our missions, is to try and look at some of the invasive plants that Farron used and see if we can't make substitutions with native plants, or at least non-invasive plants, that will provide better ecosystem services and habitat. So that's a big focus really throughout the gardens. We've already started a couple projects, and we'll be carrying that through probably for the next 10 years, because it's a slow and steady process, because we want to do it very thoughtfully. We want to maintain the look and feel of the gardens and the privacy and things like that. So we're not just wholesale ripping things out. And there are some invasive plants like the wisteria, for example, that are so iconic to the design intent that we will not be removing them. But there are other plants like privet, for example, which can easily be substituted with a fragrant white spring blooming native shrub that would fill the design intent requirements while also serving the habitat better.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you if there was a plan for replacing some of those. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, we've already started down Melisande's LA, which is on the eastern side of the property close to Montrose Park. And behind the LA was just a mess of invasive plants. And so we've removed a portion of them. We didn't want to remove them all, because it really would have opened up the edge of the property and really taken away the privacy and the kind of meditative quality of that LA. So we removed enough that we could get some native plants in. We planted about 100 deciduous native shrubs, and this was in 2019. And last year we weren't able to continue because of COVID and just having to triage our maintenance in the gardens, but we're now coming back this year with some evergreen shrubs. I'm very excited to try this Magnolia virginiana variety called Sweet Thing, which is a dwarf Virginia magnolia, Sweet Bay magnolia. We're going to try that as well as some other things in there, and get an evergreen backbone so that we can remove the rest of the invasives, and then we will maintain a privacy buffer with native plants.
Exciting. I can't wait to see how that Sweet Thing develops and to check on that in maybe 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. This has been fascinating. And for all of those listeners who have been to Dumbarton Oaks, I'm sure it brings back wonderful memories. And those who have never been to Dumbarton Oaks, I would say put that on your life list.
Yes, we'd love to have you.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Kathy.
Prickly pear plant profile. The eastern prickly pear cactus, Opuntia humifusa, or Opuntia compressa, is the only cactus native to the mid-Atlantic, and though it looks like a desert dweller, it is perfectly hardy here. It is closely related to the fragile prickly pear from the Great Plains and Drummond's prickly pear, occurring in the southeastern United States. It prefers rocky or sandy soil with good drainage. Planted along a sidewalk edge, slope, or retaining wall. It also grows well in containers. It needs full sun and to be kept relatively dry. Prickly pear form clumps and spread slowly. It can be propagated by seed or by breaking off a pad and sticking it in the soil cutting side down. The plant is hardy from USDA zones 4 to 9. It can survive freezing temperatures, though it may look a little sad when it dehydrates and wrinkles during the winter months. The plant has beautiful yellow flowers in early summer, which are then followed by red fruits. Prickly pear fruit is edible, as are the cactus paddles, also called nopalis. Wear thick gloves whenever handling any part of the plant. The brown bristles and spines are easy to see and avoid, but the fruits are also covered in small hair-like spines that can get under your skin like splinters. Prickly pear is a fun plant to grow that is a great conversation piece in the garden. It's also beneficial for pollinators, and the fruit is eaten by various wildlife. What's new in the garden this week? Well, before I dive into that, I wanted to give a thank you to our latest listener supporter, Saw. Thank you so much for helping support this program. And thank you to all the past and current listener supporters that help make Garden DC possible. Over at our community garden plot, we've reseeded a few things that never came up for us. We kind of had some radish seeds and arugula that just never germinated. And we don't know if it was because the seeds weren't good or it was because of the torrential rains that happened shortly after we planted them. So we've replaced them with new radish seeds, new arugula seeds, and we'll see how those do. Meanwhile, what is doing good are the lettuces, the bok choy, and the spinach. So we have lots of greens coming up for this cool season in the vegetable garden. Over at my home garden, I think the standout plant this week literally is the Tartarian aster, that big 6 foot tall plant that might be a little bit floppy sometimes, but is incredible at the back of a garden with those beautiful purple blooms. And we're going to do a plant profile coming up on the Aster Tartaricus. So, happening in the local gardening world, I wanted to bring your attention to some great news. If you hadn't heard already, the American Horticultural Society is staying at River Farm. Yay! So, they are not going to be purchased. They are not for sale. So, they will be staying for now at River Farm, right down the road from Mount Vernon, outside of Alexandria, Virginia. And then locally, we have a couple virtual events that you can attend online that are normally in person, but now it opens up the possibility for anybody in the world to attend them. And the first is the Mid-Atlantic Urban Agricultural Summit that takes place October 12th through 14th. And you can find out about that at the Virginia Cooperative Extension website. And that is a nominal fee, I believe, of $25 to attend 3 days of programming. So check that out if you are into vegetable growing, and especially if you are in an urban or small space area. The other conference coming up that I wanted to bring your attention to is the annual Perennial Plant Conference. And this year's title is Perennial Plants for the Mid-Atlantic and How to Use Them in Landscapes. It's taking place, again, online, Friday, October 15th, And you can sign up for that at perennialplantconference.org. And that conference has a registration fee as well. And that's held by the Scott Arboretum on the campus of Swarthmore College normally. And I urge you to go out and visit some of our public gardens. In today's episode, we talked about Dumbarton Oaks, and we just congratulated American Horticultural Society for keeping its home at River Farm. But if you are in the DC area, there are some wonderful public gardens to visit, and you can go to dcgardens.com and see many of them profiled there. If you are anywhere close to the Philadelphia area, you can check out America's Garden Capital website for 30 wonderful public gardens that you can visit in that area. And if you are outside both those areas, we urge you to come and visit us and our public gardens, but also to explore the public gardens in your own area. Happy gardening! Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.